I think there are three things to say here. So the first is that there are two types of penal colonies, if you like. So the first are national penal colonies. So that's where convicts are transported over land distance, so large areas of land, or to islands that are just offshore. So a good example of the former would be the Russian transportations to the Russian Far East, to Siberia. And for the latter, we have a good example in Japan, where convicts were sent from the main island of Japan to Hokkaido, and also some of the islands used by various Latin American nations after independence in the early 19th century. The second type is the imperial formation, which is the one I think we're most familiar with now. So that is to say, global powers are sending convicts to penal colonies over large sea distances to colonies, whether in Africa, in Asia, or in the Caribbean and the Atlantic world. In terms of comparability, I think it's important to note that all of these types, national and imperial transportations, shared particular features. And so there is a certain comparability between them. So the first is that sending convicts is a form of punishment. It's punitive. So that could be for a particular criminal act, but it could also be a punitive mode for getting rid of enemies or political enemies or enemies of society and government and so on. The second that's important to note, again for both nations and empires, is that there's a colonizing element. So convicts are used as often the first pioneers in particular locations to settle new places that haven't yet been settled. It's interesting to look at whether women were sent in that regard. So sometimes no women are sent at all. So what the powers try to do is to use male convicts to clear land, build infrastructure, get the ground ready for larger flows of migrants. However, if they send women, they normally have a longer term goal of hoping that convicts will settle down, have families, and themselves become migrants. So you see that, for example, in Sakhalin Island, where that was the hope, in the Russian Far East, and in the Britain's Australian penal colonies, where women were always sent. I'd also like to say, sometimes people assume that convicts were sent because other people wouldn't go, they refused to go. But my own view is that in many of these locations, there was a preference for convict labour because convicts are expendable. If convicts die, it doesn't matter to some degree. So, for example, enslaved people are property of governments or individuals. And if an enslaved person dies in a colonizing mission, then you lose the value of their labor. But of course, convicts are not enslaved. They do not represent investment by an individual or the state. So often there is a preference for convict labor because of their expendability. The final thing I'd like to say, and again, this is something that we can see comparing nations and empires in various contexts, is that there's a shift over time. So during the early period, so say until the end of the 18th century, we see convicts blend in with other kinds of labours. So it's very common for convicts to be sent with enslaved persons, with soldiers, with indentured labourers, with vagrants, with paupers, with all kinds of marginalised populations. So for example, in the Portuguese presidios in North Africa, it's hard to tell who's a convict because they're mixed in with many, many other groups. What we see over time is that new kinds of penal colonies are established where only convicts go. So they're more discreet, they're more isolated. They're a kind of locus for convict society to grow up. So some of the very famous ones that we all know about, we have Australian New South Wales, We have Australian Van Diemen's Land or Tasmania. And of course, in the French Empire, we have French Guiana, Guyane, and Nouvelle Caledonie, New Caledonia. So these are very, very well known. But there are also a number of other sites which are less well known and which our project tried to elevate to a rightful position in history. So those would include, for example, Hokkaido in Japan, which I mentioned earlier, the Andaman Islands in the Bay of Bengal, which was a British Indian settlement, the Dutch East Indies, where many thousands of convicts were sent from the early modern period right through to the 20th century, and then in Argentina, Ushuaia, which is in Patagonia. So again, a place that we don't associate as being a penal colony, but it certainly was. We hoped we might discover some information, and we actually found a lot more than we ever had imagined, and there are absolutely lots of examples of this. So, for example, we see in the British in India, for example, read all the Australian reports when they start to set up their own penal settlements at the end of the 18th century. They are very aware of the new colonization of Sydney Cove, of New South Wales, and they read later reports on the management of the Australian penal colonies and start to copy the system for managing convicts. So we see this remarkable parallel between Singapore and Sydney, which is not something that you would imagine. France studies the Australian colonies at great length. So you may know that just as penal transportation from Britain and Ireland to Australia is ending, penal transportation from the French colonies and from France to French penal colonies is just beginning. So France is rather late to the transportation party, so to speak. They read a lot about the Australian colonies, and actually we can find all of those records, those translations, those discussions in Aix-en-Provence at the Archives Outre-mer. So we don't have to read between the lines, the material is all there. Russia, which as you will know was a very francophone country in the 19th century in the elite circles, they are reading all about French penal colonies as they are initiating their transportations to Sakhalin, to the Russian Far East at the end, towards the end of the 19th century. Over the course of the 19th century, a formal way of exchanging knowledge about punishment emerges in the form of an organization called the International Penitentiary Congress. So this meets, the IPC, it meets every 5 years from 1872, apart from during the two world wars. And dozens of delegates meet physically in various European capitals, and there are hundreds of corresponding members. Before the Congress meets, people submit questions, and those questions are then discussed at the meetings. And we find quite a lot about penal transportation, particularly at the end of the 19th century, when France is under attack for supposed cruelty in French Guiana. And the French, not surprisingly, are very defensive about the value and the importance of penal transportation within the judicial system. So we have some very nice records on that. Interestingly, one of the congresses was held in St. Petersburg, and the delegates actually go to the Moscow prison where they see prisoners awaiting their transportation to Siberia. And the dinner for that particular event was held at the Tsar's Winter Palace. So these very lavish, enjoyable affairs, despite the topic. So in terms of specific techniques of punishment, one of the really interesting ones is called the mark system, and this circulates widely. So let me explain what it was. The mark system was developed by Alexander McConachie in Norfolk Island in Australia, and the idea was that convicts would not serve time. They would not serve 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. Their release would depend on their behaviour, and they would receive marks for good behaviour, and those marks would be taken away for bad behaviour. So their sentence was not time limited. It was all to do with behaviour. Now, the mark system was not only trialled in Norfolk Island, it extends later to the Andaman Islands, where tokens were minted. They look like coins that the convicts were given. It's also very influential in Latin America, which implements in a widespread way a system where convicts move through penal stages according to their behaviour. That was known by then as the Irish system, which was the brainchild of Sir Walter Crofton, an Irishman, but he had drawn very heavily on McConaughey's earlier ideas from Norfolk Island. So we see in that example, you know, one mode that the global powers are discussing, really from Japan to Latin America and everywhere in between. It's really remarkable. We had on our project two Japanese researchers, and they looked through all of the penitentiary related journals of meetings and congresses in Japan, and we found that the Japanese were translating material on the mark system, as well as all sorts of other material, including French material and British material. And it was really astonishing to us the extent that even in Japan they were engaging with these ideas from Europe and North America. I'm not a Russian historian, as you know, but I've engaged a lot and thought a lot about where Russian history fits. And I think I've come to a conclusion, and that is that in some respects, the Gulag was not exceptional at all, in that it was in some sites looking to extract labour. So, for example, in putting convicts to work in mines, it shared experience with other penal colonies from Australia to New Caledonia, where convicts were employed in mines. And I mentioned earlier expendability, and I think that's really important here. But of course, the purpose of the Gulag was not simply to extract labour. So the purpose of the Gulag was also to get rid of political enemies, in some cases to set up special settlements for the shifting of entire families, of undesirables, supposed socially undesirable populations. And some of the settlements also undoubtedly were death camps, which can be paralleled with later Nazi extermination camps. So I think some elements of the Gulag does share features with other penal colonies. The crucial difference is one of scale. So the Soviets shipped people to these settlements, to gulags, in a scale that was absolutely unprecedented, in the millions and millions of millions. And on our project, we put together some graphs where we map the flows of convicts, so we can see, for example, flows of Portuguese, Spain, France, Britain. And you see these very nice lines, very interesting. When we added the Soviet, all of those lines collapse to a tiny straight line at the bottom because the scale of the Soviet mobilities were so huge. So I would say in some ways they shared features, in other ways they didn't. What is absolutely unprecedented is the scale of what happened.